is seeking to do right now is to apply internal pressure through unleashing its underground collaborator networks and their underground hidden cells in order to wreak havoc, to pressurize Iran. So perhaps it might be able to get some concessions on an international scene. It was a pretext to also put sanctions, for example, on Iran to weaken it. But it's not quote-unquote regime change. That's too far.
Basically using day tactics to try and get what they want out of Iran. And I think it's worth mentioning that there were huge protests in support of the Islamic Republic during this whole affair. That's something worth mentioning as well. But thank you very much to both of my guests today. It's been a very enlightening discussion, to say the least. But that's all the time we have for this edition of Eye on Islam. But join us next week for another edition. And for now, Assalamu Alaikum.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The aftershocks caused by the coronavirus pandemic, the ineffectiveness of the last three governments in Britain, and the conflict in Ukraine have all joined hands to make the British economy face unprecedented challenges. One of these challenges is the instability and economic recession that has created problems for the British people and also disruption to Britain's labour market. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Bloomberg Television Network has more on this story. Britain's job shortages showed signs of easing in the third quarter as more people dropped out of work and wages grew at the fastest pace in over a year, adding to inflationary concerns for the Bank of England. Both the number of employed and unemployed fell, while 108,000 more people became economically inactive in the 3 months to September. That took the total increase in those not seeking work since the start of the pandemic to 630,000. The figure from the Office for National Statistics, ONS, underlined the case for the central bank to keep raising interest rates. Policymakers are seeking to head off a wage price spiral after consumer prices jumped 10.1%, the most in the past four decades. James Smith, developed markets economist at ING, said, "Hiring appetite is undoubtedly past its peak, but there isn't much sign that the acute labour shortages are easing. The labour market is continuing to tighten even though the economy is slipping into recession. That's prompted companies to pay more to lure staff to fill vacancies." The Office for National Statistics revealed that despite strong growth in headline pay, real wages after adjusting for inflation shrank by 2.6%, the steepest decline since the recession in 2009. Britain has been grappling for over a year with chronic job shortages that have forced up pay and led to fears of a wage price spiral at the Bank of England. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee has raised interest rates from 0.1% last December to 3% in recent days and is expected to increase them to 3.5% next month. The squeeze has been fueled by the loss of over 500,000 workers in the past 2 years, largely due to long-term sickness. Inactivity, those neither in work nor looking for a job, rose again to 21.6% of working-age adults from July and September. Jane Grattan, head of People and Policy at the British Chamber of Commerce, said, "Although the Office for National Statistics data suggests employers may have started to scale back hiring in the face of a looming recession, the challenges in the labour market remain very much the same. We have a critical shortage of skills and labour that is damaging firms and holding back growth. Staff shortages are pushing up pay, with average weekly earnings excluding bonuses up 5.7% from a year ago, the most since August of 2021, and stronger than the 5.5% pace economists had expected. For private sector workers, regular pay is growing at the fastest pace on record outside the pandemic, gaining 6.6%. Public sector pay grew 2.2%. The Office for National Statistics said the gap between the two is the biggest ever recorded. That gap helps explain ongoing industrial action among public sector unions. Nurses are planning their first major strike in a century. Civil servants are planning industrial action, and teachers are balloting on a strike next year. The website of Yahoo News has also covered the same story. Workers in the United Kingdom saw regular pay jump 5.7%, the strongest growth since outside the pandemic period, but real wages are still falling as inflation soars and unemployment hits 3.6%. According to the Office for National Statistics, ONS, total pay, including bonuses, rose by 6% per year from July to September, while regular pay rose by 5.7%, up from 5.4%. Britain's unemployment rate has also risen amid fears that a recession is looming on the horizon, and inflation rose to 10.1% in September. The rate of unemployment stood at 3.6% in the 3 months to September, up from 3.5% in the 3 months to August. It came as more people dropped out of the workforce, with a hike in the proportion of people neither looking for work nor working. Darren Morgan, Head of Labour and Economic Statistics at the Office for National Statistics, ONS, pointed to a change in demographics that was driving the fall in the number of economically inactive people. Darren Morgan said, "The proportion of people neither working nor looking for work has risen again since the onset of the pandemic. This shift has largely been caused by older workers leaving the labour market altogether. But in the most recent quarter, the main contribution has actually come from younger groups of people. More and more businesses are holding back on recruitment as the number of job vacancies fell for a fourth straight month. The number of job vacancies dropped to 1.225 million in August to October of 2022, which is down 46,000 in May to July of 2022. The Office for National Statistics also revealed over 500,000 working days were lost to strike action in August and in September, the highest two-month total in more than a decade. Victoria Scholar, Head of Investment at Interactive Investor, said the figures show signs of an economic slowdown in Britain. Victoria Scholar said, "We are beginning to see tentative signs of an economic slowdown come through in the labour market figures, now with the job vacancies retreating from the highs as businesses make cutbacks and reduce hiring, and with unemployment rates surpassing analysts' expectations." The Business News website covers the same story from a different angle. Britain's biggest recruitment firm, Reed, said the deep cost of living crisis is pushing workers back into the jobs market as inflation forces early retirees to reevaluate their finances. The recruitment firm Reed has seen an 8% increase in applications by job seekers since the beginning of September, a sign that rising living costs are forcing people to find work. James Reed, the recruitment giant's chairman, said the increase in applications was partly driven by those coming out of retirement ahead of a fear and a potential drop in the number of jobs available. Businesses are being disrupted due to widespread shortages of workers due to premature retirements and a wave of long-term illness. Britain has seen a surge in the number of people pulling out of the job market since the pandemic reversed trends in the rest of Europe. Weekly data provided by Reed Recruitment to The Telegraph shows increasing applications in recent months as the cost of living crisis has increased. The spike in applications in October was 8% than the levels seen in early September. Reed said, "Our data shows jobs are shrinking but applications are increasing. This is also a reversal as applications are falling during the overall job boom." He added, "This will suggest that those who are not looking are now watching." He warned that the jobs boom runs the risk of turning into a two-year job slowdown as hiring slows sharply. The job market is already showing signs of change. Data from the Recruitment and Employment Confederation, a trade body, found that the number of permanent employees declined for the first time in nearly 2 years in the month of October, while vacancies dropped to record highs. The Bank of England has predicted that unemployment will rise to 6.5% from its current 3.5% if interest rates rise as the market expects. That would mean the loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs, although the unemployment peak will likely be less, as the Bank of England does not expect interest rates to rise as fast as investors bet. City forecasters currently expect unemployment to rise to around 5% by 2024.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran has rapped the European Union over anti-Tehran measures taken by the Council of the European Union. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian denounced, quote, certain political shows that have been put on display by the Council under the pretext of defending the issue of human rights. The European Council has imposed a slew of fresh sanctions against Iranian natural and legal entities. According to a statement issued by the EU foreign ministers, 20 individuals, along with one entity, the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, have been sanctioned over alleged human rights abuses. The bloc has also slapped sanctions on four more people and as many entities blacklisted over Tehran's alleged drone supplies to Russia. The bloc's new sanctions include asset freezes and travel bans to the EU. The ministers condemned what they called the widespread use of force by the Iranian authorities against protesters. The European Union last month imposed sanctions on a number of Iranian institutions and individuals, including the 24-hour English-language press TV news channel, over alleged rights violations following the recent foreign-backed riots in the country.
In the case of Iran, big tech is used as a weapon against Iranians. So Iranian voices don't come out. Iranians lose their, if they are opposed to the Western narrative, they get sanctioned. All of the Iranian media is sanctioned. Many individuals have lost their accounts. I have lost my Facebook and Instagram accounts. So these Western big tech companies, they cooperate with Western governments. But in Iran, these same media outlets make threats. They support, they help people make Molotov cocktails, and they help mobilize the rioters.
Foreign-backed riots have hit various Iranian provinces since 22-year-old woman Mahsa Amini died at the hospital on September 16th, 3 days after she collapsed at a police station. An investigation has attributed Amini's death to a medical condition rather than alleged beatings by the police. The violent riots have claimed the lives of dozens of people and security forces while also allowing terrorist attacks across the country. In the last 2 months, the terrorists have set fire to public property and tortured several Basiji members and security forces to death. Western states have been hyper-aggressively pushing the regime change agenda in form of hybrid war, making a sheer mockery of international law. Authorities in the US and the EU have openly and brazenly instigated rioters in Iran through official and unofficial channels. Iran's intelligence ministry has said the United States and the United Kingdom were directly involved in the unrest, adding that dozens of terrorists affiliated with the Israeli regime and anti-revolution groups have also been detained in the unrest.
Online, the MEK organization that's funded by and supported by NATO, they've been teaching people how to make Molotov cocktails, how to use weapons, and they've been attacking police bases, military bases, and also we've had terrorist attacks alongside the Pakistani border, in the no man land in Pakistan, and also in northern Iraq from Iraqi Kurdistan.
Iran says its enemies have waged a hybrid war against the Islamic Republic to weaken national solidarity and hinder the country's progress. Officials say huge amounts of weapons have been shipped into the country by Western and regional intelligence services to carry out terrorist attacks and conduct extensive psychological operations in order to stoke dissatisfaction amongst the Iranian people and make them accuse the Iranian administration for the growing insecurity.
The United States is finalizing plans to send Patriot missile systems to Ukraine. The plan needs the final approval of U.S. Defense Chief Lloyd Austin and the U.S. President Joe Biden. It is not known how many of the batteries will be sent to Ukraine, but reports say supplies to Ukraine will be limited. But according to available data, a typical Patriot battery includes a radar set that detects and tracks targets, computers, and a power-generating equipment. It also includes an engagement control station and up to 8 launchers, each holding 4 radio-fire missiles. The systems are likely to be sent to the U.S. Army base in Grafenwöhr, Germany, where Ukrainian soldiers are likely to be trained and use the equipment. Ukraine has long been requesting the U.S. to send advanced long-range air defense system.
The message is simple. Give Patriots as soon as you can. Because this is the system that Ukraine needs to protect its civilian population and critical infrastructure. This is not an offensive weapon.
Russia has already warned that Patriot missile systems in Ukraine, if are deployed in the conflict, will be targeted. The former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, who is now Deputy Chair of the National Security Council, had earlier warned that such weapons and their crews would be legitimate targets if a NATO member were to deliver them.
Washington уже сделал себя стороной конфликта в практической плоскости. Принимая во внимание растущие объемы прямой американской военной помощи, включая присутствие военнослужащих США на земле, передача столь сложного вооружения, обращение с которым требует многомесячной подготовки, будет означать расширение вовлеченности кадровых американских военных в боевые действия со всеми вытекающими последствиями. Настоятельно советуем тем, кто в Вашингтоне принимает решение, наконец прислушаться, возможно, не к нам, но к самим себе, сделать правильные выводы из наших неоднократных предупреждений о том, что любые поставляемые на Украину оружейные системы, в том числе Патриот, соответственно, обслуживающим персоналом были и остаются законными приоритетными целями для вооруженных сил России.
The U.S. and its Western partners have already resupplied Ukraine's air defense missiles and shoulder-fired Stinger missiles and other larger air defense systems. Patriot missile system is one of the most advanced U.S. systems against aircraft and missiles. Ukrainian officials say the delivery of Patriot missiles would be a game-changer, but the efficiency of those weapons for Ukraine in the war against Russia is not clear. Each missile battery would require dozens of well-trained air defenders to operate. Even with an accelerated training program, could be sometime in early 2023 before a system is operational in Ukraine. Experts believe the Patriot has a more powerful radar that is better at discriminating targets, but it has its own limitations. Its efficiency would depend on how the weapon was delivered. The success rate of the Patriot has been repeatedly questioned. In 2018, Saudi Arabia's success in using Patriots against missiles fired in the Yemen war were questioned when evidence of systems failing emerged. The Patriot does not reportedly perform so well against small drones. It is not known whether the system's radar could pick up the small, low-flying drones or whether there were other issues. The U.S. has now committed more than $19.3 billion in weapons and other equipment to Ukraine since the war began in February of this year.
As we work with industry to accelerate production on both replenishment systems and direct procurements under the United Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, or USAI, we're using a number of tools to get the funding moving and the contracting happen quickly. These include using contracting mechanisms called things like undefinitized contracting actions, sometimes called UCAs. What that allows you to do deliberately is to get industry working on an initial contract before we definitize it. And you can put a UCA together within a week, and we're doing that. We also are making use of indefinite delivery indefinite quantity contracts, or IDIQ. If you have IDIQs, and we have many of them, what you can do is just add task orders to them very quickly to get equipment on contract.
It is widely believed that those U.S.-made weapons are fanning the flames of war in Europe. But there are concerns that those weapons are falling into the wrong hands.
We're seeing this incredible, historic flow of weapons coming into Ukraine. Do we have any sense as to where they're going?
We don't know. There is really no information as to where they're going at all.
You know, all this stuff goes to the border, and then kind of like something happens, it kind of like 30% maybe reaches its final destination.
Washington is reportedly looking into technological solutions to the problem of weapons diversion. Western weapons earmarked for Ukraine had reportedly surfaced in the hands of militant groups in the African Sahel.
The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, says more than 11,000 Yemeni children have been killed or maimed since the Saudi-led aggression against the impoverished country began in 2015. The agency says hundreds of thousands of children also remain at risk of death from starvation or preventable diseases. That's why the true toll of the conflict is likely to be far higher. According to the agency, about 2.2 million Yemeni children are acutely malnourished. One quarter of them aged under five. Most of them are at extreme risk from cholera and other vaccine-preventable diseases. Described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis by the UN, nearly three-quarters of Yemen's population is said to be in need of humanitarian aid and protection. UNICEF is seeking over $480 million to respond to the crisis in Yemen over the next year and has warned that lack of predictable funding puts children's lives and well-being further at risk. The agency has also called on the warring sides to renew a UN-brokered truce, which was announced in April and expired in October without an agreement to extend it. At least 62 children have been killed or wounded since then. The collapse of Yemen's ceasefire risks rolling back some of the progress that has been made after the lifting of a Saudi blockade on Yemen that has prevented airplanes and ships from entering and leaving the country. While both sides have blamed the other for failure of a lasting ceasefire, Yemen's Ansarullah movement has stated that restoring peace in Yemen is not possible unless the invading countries abandon their arrogant mentality. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 with arms and logistics support from the US and other Western states. The objective was to reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi and crush the popular Ansarullah movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have died ever since, either as a result of war or indirectly through unsafe drinking water, disease outbreaks, hunger, and other impacts. In Yemen, thousands of civilian and child deaths have been blamed on Saudi-led airstrikes, which have hit markets, weddings, funerals, residential homes, and hospitals. In addition, Yemen's health ministry said last month that 80 newborn babies lose their lives on a daily basis because the war-torn country does not have the required medical equipment due to the Saudi-led war and blockade. Yemeni officials say the use of prohibited weapons is one of the reasons behind a growing trend of children's death. Several human rights organizations have already acknowledged and condemned Saudis for using such arms. Since launching the war, with the support of Washington, the Saudi-led coalition has used internationally banned weapons, including U.S.-made cluster bombs to target residential areas. Apart from the war, Riyadh has imposed a blockade on Yemen, which combined have claimed lives of hundreds of thousands of people. The military aggression has destroyed much of the country's infrastructure, including health sector. Meanwhile, Sana'a has warned foreign companies against plundering energy resources of the country, stressing that it will spare no effort to defend national sovereignty and safeguard public interests and health. The Saudi-led coalition and their proxies have looted more than $13 billion in Yemeni oil revenues between 2016 and 2021. The large amounts could have been used to pay the salaries of employees in the National Salvation Government, reduce the exchange rate, and help improve the living standards for Yemenis and alleviate their suffering. The States has revealed it was pressing the United Nations not to update a blacklist of companies doing business in illegal Israeli settlements within the occupied West Bank. That's despite Washington's calls on its ally to stop expansion in occupied Palestinian territory. State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel stated that the United States will oppose any work to update the UN blacklist and has conveyed its concern directly with the Office of the High Commissioner. In February 2020, the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights published a list of companies operating in Israeli settlements. The list comprises 112 companies, including Israeli and American ones. The initial publication, which listed U.S. companies including Airbnb, Expedia, and TripAdvisor, was denounced by then-administration of Donald Trump, which had reversed long-standing U.S. opposition to settlements in the West Bank. The statement comes just days after the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken claimed that the Biden administration would oppose the Israeli settlement expansion and any bid to annex the West Bank. Since 1967, the Israeli occupation has established more than 230 settlements in the West Bank and Al-Quds, with over 500,000 settlers living in them to date. Despite the UN Security Council condemning the building of settlements, which under international law are all illegal, the Israelis continue expanding the annexation of more Palestinian land until today, with no prospect of stopping in the future. Palestine has slammed the U.S. move to pressure the United Nations not to update its list of companies operating in Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki told Voice of Palestine that the Palestinian leadership rejects any U.S. pressure on the UN and its operating institutions. He added that his ministry is working to arrange a meeting with the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk. His remark came after U.S. State Department announced that Washington continues to oppose any action to update the list and has raised concerns directly with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Emboldened by Washington's all-out support, Israel's illegal settlement activities surged under former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu during Trump's administration. The construction activities are in defiance of United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334, which pronounced settlements in the West Bank and East Al-Quds a flagrant violation under international law. In a speech on Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that Washington would judge Benjamin Netanyahu's incoming regime by actions and not personalities. Controversial Israeli politician Netanyahu is likely to return to power after striking a coalition deal with the extreme right outfits, including religious Zionism, which could be put in charge of constructing illegal settlements and the Tel Aviv regime's land grab policies in the occupied Palestinian territories. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called on the international community to criminalize Israeli violations against Palestinians and to hold the occupying regime accountable for its crimes. The movement has stressed that Israeli crimes constitute a flagrant violation of the principles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the international law, reaffirming its commitment to the legitimate Palestinian rights.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
After two decades that have passed since the beginning of the illegal occupation of Afghanistan by American, British, and NATO forces, new dimensions of the crimes of the invaders are publishing every day. In one of them, the British ministers recently have announced an inquiry into charges of more than 50 summary killings by Special Air Service soldiers in Afghanistan, a decision made after years of reports that British occupying troops killed civilians in cold blood. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Please stay tuned. The website of Euronews writes, Britain's military has announced it will launch an inquiry into reports that its special forces carried out dozens of extrajudicial killings in Afghanistan. Junior Defence Minister Andrew Morrison said in the House of Commons on Thursday, December 15th, that the UK Ministry of Defence, MOD, would concede to long-standing demands for an independent statutory inquiry. BBC reported earlier this year that British Elite Special Air Service, SAS, killed Afghan civilians in cold blood. Morrison admitted the Afghanistan inquiry, which is to start in early 2023, will focus on unlawful killings by the British Special Forces during deliberate detention operations in Afghanistan from mid-2010 to mid-2013. It will also examine the adequacy of subsequent investigations by the Ministry of Defence in two charges of wrongdoing, including murder. However, Morrison noted the inquiry will ensure that all service personnel, veterans and current and former civil servants who are asked to engage with the inquiry will be given full legal and pastoral support. The announcement follows reports that 54 Afghans were killed in suspicious circumstances by one SAS unit in Helmand province between 2010 and 2011, and charges that this amounted to war crimes. Tessa Gregory from the UK law firm, which is representing the families of the deceased, said an inquiry should have been launched years ago. She said the charges of extrajudicial killings and cover-up are of such gravity, and the concerns expressed contemporaneously within the British and Afghan army and by a reputable international organization working on the ground in Afghanistan were so serious and so widespread that an inquiry should have been instituted by the government years ago. The families of eight people, including three young boys reportedly murdered by British special forces in two separate operations during night raids in Afghanistan in 2011 and 2012, welcomed the inquiry, saying they waited 10 years for justice. One of the family members said, "Over 10 years ago, I lost two of my brothers, my young brother-in-law, and a childhood friend, all boys with a life ahead of them," adding, "I was handcuffed, beaten, and interrogated outside our family home by British troops. My relatives and friends were each shot in the head as they sat drinking tea." The family member said, "My family had waited 10 years to find out why this happened." Meanwhile, The Guardian Daily reports ministers have announced a statutory judge-led inquiry into allegations of more than 50 summary killings by SAS soldiers in Afghanistan, a decision made after years of reports that elite British troops killed civilians in cold blood. In a statement to the House of Commons, Andrew Morrison, the Minister for Defence, said Lord Justice Haddon Cave would take on the job, and work would start in earnest in 2023. Haddon Cave will stand down for his job as a senior presiding judge for England and Wales to focus on the task. John Healy, the Shadow Defence Secretary, said this special inquiry is welcome and must succeed. "It is essential to protect the reputation of our British Special Forces, guarantee the integrity of military investigations, and secure justice for any of those affected." A High Court case brought by the law firm Lay Day on behalf of one man, Saifullah, charged that his father, two brothers, and a cousin were killed during an SAS raid on a compound in southern Afghanistan in February 2011. It was called Objective Tyburn by the SAS, referring to a historic place of execution in London. Evidence from disclosures required by the courts indicated that Afghan men detained on SAS night raids were often separated from their families and shot dead after they were claimed to have unexpectedly produced a hand grenade or an AK-47 rifle. Saifullah legal team sought a judicial review, arguing that the MOD did not properly investigate charges of unlawful activity and that Britain had breached its human rights obligations by not properly examining them. Internal correspondence revealed that a Special Air Services Sergeant Major described the episode as the latest massacre. In an email sent the following morning after the report on a mission that led to the deaths of Saifullah family members was filed, concerns about SAS activity in Afghanistan have been circling around the MOD for years, but criminal investigations were closed 3 years ago without any prosecutions being brought. In 2014, military police launched Operation Northmoor, an investigation into charges of more than 600 offences by British occupation forces in Afghanistan, including the killing of innocent civilians by the SAS. It was wound down in 2017 and closed in 2019, and the MOD said no evidence of criminality was found. The website of Al Jazeera writes the BBC reported following its own four-day probe, unarmed Afghan men were routinely shot dead in cold blood by SAS troops during nighttime raids. The weapons were planted on them to justify the crimes. The Ministry of Defense said in a statement it will also scrutinize the adequacy of the response by the Ministry of Defense, MOD, to the concerns raised about the troops' conduct and assess what lessons can be learned. Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said in a statement, if there are further lessons to learn, it is right that we consider those fully to ensure all charges are handled appropriately and in equal measure. Wallace said the MOD had made a number of changes in recent years to deal with serious allegations of wrongdoing, including the creation of a Defence Serious Crime Unit. The BBC's Panorama program investigation said senior officers, including General Mark Carlton Smith, who headed UK Special Forces at the time, were aware of concerns within the SAS about the operations, but failed to report them to military police. Under UK law governing the armed forces, it is a criminal offence for commanding officers to fail to inform the military police if they become aware of potential war crimes. In July, before the broadcast of one such program, the MOD accused the broadcaster of engaging in irresponsible, incorrect journalism by being prepared to air the charges in the first place. However, within 24 hours of that statement, there were signs of a change of heart. Military police began a fresh investigation into the charges, in which the BBC and other organizations were asked to share information, and which led to the recent statement.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University, and researcher in the Hausa Ilvia of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Professor Nakavi, we would like to start today's discussion with an audience question. We have a lady from India who is saying that, I have a niece who is 16 years old and she does not observe hijab. And when we talk to her, she ignores. And when I talk to her mother, she says she is still a child. While as in our previous discussions, you said practical Islamic laws should not be observed at puberty, rather much before than that. And 16 is a very far from the age of puberty for girls. So what do you say on that note?
Yes, exactly. I mean, even if we consider some of the opinion of some ulama who consider the age of puberty to be 13 for girls, even compared to that, 16 is too much, is beyond that age. Normally, the general opinion is 9 years of age. But even if it is 13, then 16 is beyond that. The most thing, important thing is observing hijab, as I said, importantly, everything that a child or a person should do in his life or life for the sake of Islam, for the sake of Allah Almighty. It is very clear that in Islam, we say Allah says, like Rafidin. You can't enforce people to do things. They have to do it with their own personal volition, voluntarily, with sincerity. So you cannot enforce things upon others. Like Rafidin does not mean that we can't impose Islamic laws. We can't, though it's not necessary for them to observe hijab if they don't want to do so.
And especially the youth today, you can't impose anything
on
them.
Yes, you can't impose. But that does not mean that Islam does not want them to observe hijab. Islam wants to say, like Rafidin, I mean, I don't want to enforce this upon you, impose it upon you. I want you to do it voluntarily,
with the
reasoning
behind, with sincerity.
You should know why I'm telling you this. Either you understand the reason or you don't understand the reason, but at least you should know that when I'm telling you to do something, it's because of you, what is beneficial for yourself in this world and the hereafter. Therefore, 16 years, she should have been prepared for that before that, at an early age, at a tender age. There she would have been able to easily copy her parents, or the women at least, in the family. So that is a problem for the whole society. But especially if one in one's household, one sees the elder women, elder sisters or the mother or the grandmother, they are observing the hijab, so it becomes an easy thing for the child at a tender age. But when one comes to the age of puberty and adolescence, there, one, if a person becomes a little bit, as we will talk about the changes that come about in a child at that age, at a young person, the physical changes are taking place, mental changes are taking place,
changes.
He or she becomes quite aggressive. He or she is starting to develop the understanding, or the cognitive process is developing such a way that he or she is challenging everything, questioning everything. So there the parents have to deal with that stage very, very tenderly, and not to react in such a way that aggressiveness is increased. Therefore, unfortunately, what happens is if a child is not prepared beforehand, then at that age, which is the age of adolescence, it is a sensitive age, and it's not very difficult to impose anything upon a child. Therefore, we have in the ahadith, which we have received from the Holy Prophet, it is mentioned that the first 7 years, the second 7 years, the third 7 years,
The entire process of tarbiyah is divided
into three
phases.
So if that first stage is observed properly, then we can come to a stage where a person is ready to accept the words of
and
the elders.
And each following phase would become
easier
as we have practiced.
And so the person who is saying that my niece is not doing so, number one, yes, it is necessary for her to carry out Amr al-Ma'ruf wa Nahy al-Munkar for that child. For her mother, and explain to her also that 16 is not an age where she should not be observing it. And that is her responsibility.
Yeah, we'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I am with Professor Naqavi, and we are discussing about adolescence. We discussed an audience question wherein a lady was actually concerned about her 16-year-old niece who was not observing hijab. But Professor Naqavi, you said that before this lady starts doing Amr bin Ma'ruf, inviting towards good to the 16-year-old, she should be doing same for her mother, because as a guide, as a parent, as a trainer, if she observes, then it would be very easy for the daughter to observe it.
Exactly, that is so. I mean, if the mother is resisting, that, then how can we expect for the child, her daughter, to accept what her auntie is saying? And therefore, the responsibility becomes a little more difficult for the lady who wants to make the child observe hijab. She must work on the mother first. And the mother, if she wanted to make her observe hijab 16, would be very late for that.
Yeah, but unfortunately, even I have lived in societies wherein if you're teens and you're observing hijab, and then the old women would come and would tell you, are you an auntie that you're putting on hijab? Because they have portrayed, they have actually perceived the image of hijab-wearing girls as the elderly women.
Unfortunately, that is the difficult situation which we find ourselves today, that observing, of course, I'm not saying that hijab is the only thing which has to be taken care of, but it is a symbolic thing for a Muslim lady, for a faithful, practicing Muslim, to observe hijab as a symbol of her faith, as a symbol of our being a religious person.
In fact, the symbol of your modesty.
Exactly. I mean, we should make people realize, women folk especially, that hijab is not a limitation. It is rather emancipation. It gives freedom. It gives dignity. You cover things up which are precious. If you have the crown, if you have jewelry in your house, you will cover them up in something which will provide them protection.
You won't put that in the access of every third person.
Exactly. So something is covered which is precious. Therefore, one should understand that hijab, we should make people understand that hijab is not a limitation. It is not being imposed. It is an obligation which Allah Almighty has made necessary for us for the sake of giving us dignity, providing a society with peace, tranquility, in a society where people do not observe. Hijab is, of course, not just hijab is not just clothing. Hijab is a condition. It's not just only wearing a scarf or a veil or whatever. Hijab is a condition. It has to be observed in one's attire. One has to be observed in one's eyes. It has to be observed in one's way of talking. It has to be observed in one's way of walking.
That's so beautiful.
I mean, this is which is there in the Quran. For each and every of these instances, Quran is talking about the hijab.
Yeah.
Hijab is just limited to one thing.
Yeah.
So, and it's not only for women, it's for men also.
Yeah. We would love to know about that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet ﷺ said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I am with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing the concept of hijab, how you can teach this concept to your adolescents. Well, Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you touched a very, very important point, that when you're teaching hijab to adolescents, it's not just the outer covering to be taught to daughters. It's also something that you got to teach to your boys.
Exactly.
How?
I mean, as I was mentioning, it has been mentioned in the Holy Quran that men folk should lower their gazes, women folk should lower their gazes. That is the hijab in the eyes.
Wow.
That is to be taken care of. Of course, the basic thing is that one of the issues that is there in the hijab, or in any way, anything which is related to hijab, any form, any thought, or anything which leads to feelings which arise in us, which are specifically feelings which are there between a man and his wife, as a husband and wife, the feelings which are aroused to carry out the sexual relationship, that is very necessary. If that is not there, one cannot carry out that union of the man and woman to create that relationship which leads to the offspring. That is something natural. It has to be there. Those desires, those feelings, those emotions are very important for the sustenance of human life. But they have to be managed. They have to be controlled.
When it comes to non-mahrams especially.
When it becomes to non-mahrams. And therefore, any condition which leads to the arousal of such feelings in any other condition which is apart from the relationship between the man and the wife are condemnable. They cannot be allowed. Even if a person is looking at some as at a statue and those feelings are created, it is not permissible. One should desist from observing or looking at a thing. What to say of a non-mahram person? So the hijab in the eyes is desisting and reserve and restraining oneself and refraining from looking at anything which leads to those feelings. So that is one thing. That is important. Or touching something which causes those feelings. Or any condition which you can find yourself in where those feelings are aroused and you are not able to satisfy yourself in the halal way, they have to be
controlled and managed.
Therefore, if it is as a result of looking at a person,
someone, so you have
or
to
talking
to
someone, or listening to someone, or even trying to, even walking in a way that causes those feelings to arise in the other person.
You've got to control all that.
They have to. So the basic thing is that those feelings have to be managed.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Professor Naqavi, for being with us and for giving us such a beautiful concept of hijab and answering this question in the best possible way you could. Dear sisters and daughters listening out there, if I say to myself that hijab is something which, it's for myself, so I won't be doing it for myself. It's all about my grave. It's all about my choice. It's all about my life, as per the so-called hashtags. No, it's about the modesty of your brothers that you could help in, that you could maintain, in addition to your own modesty. Thank you so much for being with us. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.